act dumb or something, right? But you start to realize that they've got this plan. So decision one, they're going to bribe them. Decision two, they're going to come up with this convoluted lie. Decision number three shows up in verse 14. Because here's the problem. If you are a Roman guard and you fall asleep on duty, one of two bad things happens to you. Number one, you could just be simply decommissioned, which doesn't sound so bad, but if you lost your job today, it might be fairly jarring. It's like, tomorrow, don't come back to work. You're done. And you've known nothing else. You have no other employable skills because Roman centurion work doesn't like translate into other things. So that's the lesser of the consequence. The more significant and actually not uncommon is they just kill you. It's like you didn't do your job, the one job you had, and so it's over. I mean, you go to places like Acts 12, you'll see this actually happening. You know, when centurions didn't do, it's like, okay, you didn't do your job. It's not like we're going to discipline you or punish you. It's like, we'll just kill you and move on to the next. There's lots of people waiting to be soldiers in the Roman army. We'll just gather a new one. So they come up with this explanation because if you're a Roman centurion or soldier and you're going to go with this story of the disciple stole his body because we were asleep, the next question is like, how much money would you have to be paid to tell that story if the most likely consequence is the next day they will kill you? Like, is there enough money that you could, like, I'll take that. No, like, so the next decision they make in verse 14, if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. We'll cover it. Don't worry about it. We got your backs. Three decisions. Coming to this great cover-up. Ray and Olga, hi, by the way. Desai in the back corner. Welcome home. So they're going to be kept out of trouble. Now, you start to see how this is like the next slice of bread, the plan in verse 62 to 66 of chapter 27. Now the outcome of the plan that has sort of fallen asleep or fallen apart because the body was taken. So verse 15, they took the money and did as they were directed. And the story has been spread among the Jews to this day. What's really interesting, if you pay attention to the language, and we'll come back to this maybe next week, this is like the anti-commission. If you know the language used typically for the end of Matthew chapter 28, we call what comes next, what we're going to deal with next week, the Great Commission. This is what all the disciples of Jesus are now supposed to go. We are to go into all the world and preach the gospel and teach people to obey and baptize them and do those things. This is like the other team's commission. They're also going to go and tell people something. And they have been doing their job because 30 years after the fact, it's still happening. They're going and tell people that the tomb, while it was empty because the disciples stole the body. Now, a few things, again, from our 102 stories up above. Don't miss the fact that Matthew is actually doing the thing that he records Jesus telling his disciples to do. 30 years later, he's preaching the gospel. It's what the whole book's about. He shared the gospel. He's told the life of Jesus. But notice where the exclamation point comes. It's like, he has risen. In Greek, it's one word. It's the most plain, it's not even a particularly exciting sounding word. Did you wake up this morning? Yes, you got out of bed. The word to get up is this word. If you got out of bed, you did the same thing that is being described when Jesus was in his tomb, because he was in his tomb. Like, look back at verse 6 of chapter 28. He is not here, for he got up. Like, really? Does that not feel almost casual to you? But that's the power that Jesus has. It's like, is death really a problem? No. He just got up. When you go and read places like Ephesians chapter 1, like, I think that puts it into context. Let me just remind you of the power that is being displayed for us. I do not cease to give thanks to you, Paul says to the believers, remembering you in my prayers that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give you the spirit of wisdom, of revelation, and the knowledge of him, having the eyes of your heart enlightened, that you may know the hope to which he's called you and what the riches of his for the saints, and what is the immeasurable greatness of his power towards us who believe according to the working of his great might, that he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places. Goes on and talks about the incredible power and authority that Jesus has, that when Jesus is dead in a tomb, then he just gets up. Because death has no power and authority over him. And one day, one day we will all breathe our last. But if we put our trust in Jesus Christ, when that last breath comes, we'll just get up. Because Jesus conquered sin and death. Like it is spectacular because of how casual it feels. It's like he didn't have to flex every muscle, just got up. I'm amazed how Matthew portrays this scene. So we're looking down on it from this height and we see all the powers of the world gathered, essentially of the known world. We've got the might of Rome represented by Pilate and all the guards of the Roman armies. We've got the best and brightest of the Jewish leadership who have gathered together to make sure that they can quash this. And then we just have Jesus. And you start to get the effect of what Matthew is showing us. It's like you can have all the powers of the world arrayed against him. And he just gets up and defeats sin and death. I think that's the effect. That's what Matthew wants you to be staggered by. It's like, how is that possible that everything was arrayed against him? And he defeated it all. In fact, look what comes next, which we'll get to next week as we look a little bit further at this Great Commission passage. Verse 16, now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, and some doubted. You ever have those moments? Like the moment that was just described a few verses later when the women saw Jesus and they feared with great joy, like where your heart's just like, man, I've got questions, I've got struggles, anxieties, but I trust him. I worship, but how does this work? I've got fears, but I've got great joy. I think that's just part of the journey of following Jesus. When that happens to your soul and in your heart, don't let Satan say, because of those things, you're disqualified. You just grab hold of Jesus. Okay, where were we? Verse 18. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. When I was in Bible school, I remember we learned the meaning of all. All means all, and that's all means. I don't know how many times that came up through the years of school. We just need to remember that. All authority on heaven and earth. Whatever is going on around you in your lives, all authority still belongs to Jesus. And in this moment where you see the authority of the world arrayed against the authority of Jesus, and back to our sandwich, right? The guards and the religious elite and Rome on either side, and then right in the middle, what do we have? We have the scene that Pastor Tyler read for us. After Sabbath, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, this is for us. And behold, pay attention, do not miss. You're not going to see it. You're not going to feel the earthquake, but don't miss what's happening. A great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven, came, rolled back the stone, and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, his clothing white as snow, and for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the woman, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen as he said. That's an interesting moment. Obviously, just in and of itself, it's like the tomb's empty. But there's a moment that is very similar to that that took place in Matthew already. Similar because all the language overlaps. It's back in chapter 17 when Jesus took three of his disciples. They went to the top of a mountain. We know it as the Mount of Transfiguration. In that scene, it's like the glory of Jesus was like just for a brief moment, it's like the curtain pulled back and we got to see a little of Jesus in his glory. And how's the description? He shone. He appeared like glowing white. The same language used to describe the angel there. And then it goes on and it starts to describe the response of the disciples. They are filled with fear. In fact, let me read you, because it's very interesting as you work through that passage, which we won't have time to do all of it, but they are terrified by what's going on in this moment. And then Jesus says this to them in verse 7. He came and touched them. I love that part. And he said, rise and have no fear. Now, they're not dead needing to be resurrected. They've dropped to the ground in their fear, but it's all the same language. Rise, get up, don't have fear. Okay, something about the resurrection and the transfiguration, it's like Matthew's wanting you to connect some dots. In fact, it continues on because you saw that little bit near the end of it, that the angel saying, you know, he's not here, he's risen, as he said. Now, when did he say that would happen? Coming down from the mountain, at the Mount of Transfiguration. That's when he told his disciples. He said, don't tell anyone until I've risen from the dead. Now, they don't. It's almost like it goes right over their heads, but that's the moment. It's like the dot is, it's just connected in incredible ways. Now, why might that matter? Well, here's what I would suggest. In Matthew chapter 17, that moment when Jesus goes to the top of the mountain, it is all about the validation of the Son. Like the key moment is the Father speaking. It's like, that is my Son, listen to him. Right? Like if you want to validate who Jesus is and his authority, that's your moment. And then Matthew 28. Again, a moment of validation. We sang it actually this morning, interesting enough, when we sang about, you know, the very fact that, you know, his body was buried. And there's actually a couple songs where it referenced the essential idea that Easter seals the deal. I think that was the language. It sealed it. In other words, you know, we look and we go, okay, at the cross, Jesus died for our sins. It's like, but how do you know it was effective? How do you know God accepted that sacrifice? How do you know it accomplished what Jesus claimed it was going to accomplish? What Paul explains as he unpacks the sort of the entire book of Romans, which is all about what's happening at the cross of Jesus. What does atonement mean? How do you know it worked? Because the tomb was empty. It seals it. It guarantees it. It makes it so that we know it really, really happened. That's why this moment is so important. That's why Matthew's going to end here at this moment and say, if you want to know Jesus, you can't know him aside from his resurrection. From that 102-story viewpoint, if you're going to share your faith and tell the gospel like Matthew is, you can't tell it unless you come to the resurrection. That's why Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, he's like, hey, let me tell you what the gospel is all about. Let me tell you what's of first importance. And then what does he do? He's like, Jesus died. He was buried, and he rose again exactly as he said. And then he goes on, he's like, and then here's the witnesses of the disciples, the witnesses of the 500. Even I saw the resurrected Lord. Like, what's the emphasis? The emphasis is resurrection. He's not dead. He rose again. Now, that's a pretty important thing. Thank you, Matthew, for helping me understand that when I share my faith, if I miss the resurrection, I've missed the gospel. There's another important thing that we see from this sort of 102-story level. It's like, you're going to have opposition. There is an enemy, and he opposes those who declare this truth. And he does it through lies. He does it through cunning. The kingdom that we oppose, that we are against, that fights against us, just be aware of their tactics. You see them almost right here. It's like, they use money and they use power and violence. Power / violence. It's like if your thought is ever like, hey, we got to solve this thing and the solution is like money or we'll just overpower our enemies, it's like just be aware that you're probably finding yourself playing on the wrong team. Matthew just won't have anything. You see it, the chief priest is like, we got a problem. What do we do? It's like, well, kill him, bribe him. You see how that works? That's the kingdom of the evil one. The kingdom of Jesus is boldly proclaim the truth with courage and conviction, and make sure you share the good news that Jesus has risen. He got up, just as he said he would do. Now, the interesting part of this, if I can embolden you a little bit, is that the attacks of the enemy as you do that are weak. They don't feel weak. I've had lots of conversations over the years where people are, I'm not sure what they would call it, let's be generous. Let's call it dialoguing with me. And they say things like, well, how do you explain all the evil in the world? There was a time in my life where I'm like, oh, I, I'm back on my heels, right? It's like, yikes, what do we do with these things? You know what I've realized over the years? It's actually, we have great answers. We have amazing answers. Like, we actually have an answer. You go back to Genesis, you talk about a perfect world that God has created, the fall of mankind, the judgment of God against sin that brings sin and decay and illness and death and the restoration work of God, the fact that we all sin. Like, we actually have a fantastic answer. You want to know what you need to do at that moment? Is you get to the end of your answer and then you say to the person, with grace, how do you explain the problem of evil in the world? And they will say something like, well, what do you mean? Or I don't know. I'm like, well, then why did you ask me the question if you don't know? And I've learned over the years, it's like when I'm asked the question, if I ask it back with grace, it's like chances are the person actually really doesn't have an answer themselves. I believe the tomb is empty because Jesus rose from the dead. Here we have a version, an answer to it. What would the other side say? Now, since about the, about 1600 AD, the swoon theory surfaced. The swoon theory is interesting. Jesus didn't actually die, just on the cross. It was pretty rough. And then they thought he was dead. It seemed so rough that they thought he was dead, so they put him in a tomb. But after 3 days, he kind of felt better, came out of the tomb, convinced everyone that he had actually risen from the dead, miraculously in power. Now, even the way I've told it, you're like, doesn't sound too plausible. Like, that's not being very charitable, Don. It doesn't make sense that a man could lose most of his blood being crucified, be put in a cold tomb, not fed, no water, wrapped in tight linens, that somehow he could get up out of that, roll away a stone from the inside, and then convince people that he was actually not just, you know, on the edge of death, but actually was miraculous. Like, that's the kind of response that the other side has to give. So here you see it here in this one version. This is the predominant version for the first 1600 years, because no one wanted to try to take the other side of the tomb wasn't empty. Like, that was a non-negotiable issue. The tomb was empty. How do we explain it? We as Christians say, Jesus rose in power from the dead. Jewish leaders, the disciples stole his body because the guards fell asleep. Like I said, already, like, guards didn't fall asleep. In fact, the whole system was built so they wouldn't. Their shifts were only like 2 to 3 hours long, 4 watches over the course of a night, so that you didn't fall asleep, so that we didn't have to kill you, so that you could make sure you did your job. But it's like, well, but if they were asleep and then the disciples came and rolled away a big stone, don't you think that might have made a little bit of noise? And then the issue of the disciples themselves, who had already all left Jesus, like, they abandoned him. It started in the Garden of Gethsemane. You notice that garden moment? They actually deny him, in essence, 3 times. It's like, it's already happening. And then when the stakes start getting a little bit higher, they all run. And yet we're supposed to believe that suddenly they stir up enough courage to come to a garden, risk being killed by the guard, to steal a body. And they leave behind the linens. Like, that's always been the weird part to me, the part that they wrapped around the dead body. Like, I am pretty sure if I was going to steal a body, this is a weird moment. Make sure if this gets on YouTube that we finish and give context. I'm not going to leave the wrapper behind. But that's all part that has to be. And then they will go out and they will proclaim this story with great courage. Go read Acts chapter 5. At the potential cost of their lives for something they knew to be a lie with nothing to be gained. And that's the story. That's what we're supposed to believe accounts for the empty tomb. You start to realize that actually we have a great position to be able to defend and explain our faith. And Matthew wants you to see it and understand it, because he wants you to have the conviction and courage that Jesus Christ has all authority in heaven and earth. Next week, we're going to look at what that means in terms of implication. But I just want you to know that the Jesus you serve, who gave his life for you, he has unbelievable power